Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. I want to remind you on our way to our conversation that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the University of Maryland Transplant Program. Nearly 2,000 Marylanders are waiting for an organ transplant. The University of Maryland conducts research and performs procedures designed to optimize transplant rates and provide least invasive surgeries for organ donors. More information about the University of Maryland's transplant program and becoming an organ donor is available online at umm.edu/transplant. Before we jump into our conversation, we'll give you the information that we do have. If you have someone who is a loved one or a friend who is in the Boston Marathon or maybe around it, and you want to find, at least for the people who are running, you can find that information. You can go to BAA.org. And when you go there, it'll be a /individual. And you can write in the name of the people you're looking for, and they will tell you what they can tell you about what's happened. And there'll be other websites and numbers we'll have for people to call, and we are waiting to give you updates during the course of the next 2 hours. As I said, it looks like now that the speculation from the police chief and the governor is that these were bombs that were set. Nobody's claimed responsibility for setting the bombs. One apparently was in a trash can. And that two people they know of at the moment were killed and at least 22 injured. But that's what we know at the moment. And so our Boston area listeners, I'm sure they're getting better news in Boston than they're getting from us here. But they've closed a number of off-ramps to get into Boston itself. And you should tune into those local stations if you're listening to us from up there to find out what's going on. But as we know things, we will tell you. And, of course, tomorrow program, we will cover it in more depth as we understand more about what's going on. So I hope nobody lost anybody up there from that we know, but call, take care, and we'll give you more information as the hours proceed here. We are joined in studio now by Dr. Margaret Flowers, co-director of itsoureconomy.us and co-host of the radio show Clearing the Fog. And Ed Conard is with us. He is American Enterprise Institute visiting scholar, author of the book Unintended Consequences, Where Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong, and Scott Lilly, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a former congressional aide. And Margaret and Ed and Scott, welcome. Good to have all of you with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, thank you, Margaret.
Good to be with you.
And the number here is 410-319-8888 to join this conversation. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Jump on to any of our Facebook pages and we'll see what you have to say there as well, and get your comments and thoughts on the air here as we start our conversation. Fun drive is over, and the lines are all open. 410-319-8888. You can join us here. So, the proposal put in by President Barack Obama has been interesting to watch just in a political sense, just because the support he has among many in his party, but also people on the left and the right decrying it for very different reasons. And it's an interesting piece. It was in the New York Times the other day, I guess, with a letter to the editor by somebody in the New York Times who said, that if you go back to the beginning of this, that all this kind of part of the root of saying what's wrong with Social Security is raiding the trust fund from the beginning. And that's a piece of discussion as well we'll talk about, where that fits in if it does fit in. But your analysis, very quickly, everybody's analysis on what we're seeing here and the necessity or the non-necessity of the proposals now to cut Social Security and Medicaid as part of a compromise package to pass this budget. Scott?
Well, there is no question that we face a serious problem with respect to long-term financing of federal retirement programs. We are going to be adding 1.5 million people per year to the ranks of the elderly in this country for the next 20 years. And that's going to put a strain on us. It's not a strain that we can't stand up to if we decide we want to, but we have a choice of either providing the benefits we now provide to the elderly or paying the taxes to support those benefits or cutting them or running up a big debt. Those aren't very pleasant choices, but if we face up to them, I think we can come out in a good place.
Ed Conard?
Yes, I think that if we, well, I certainly would agree with that characterization. I think one of the things that's always missing in the debate is that if we load heavy taxes on young people and successful risk takers and innovators, will the growth rate of our economy slow down as it has in Europe and the rest of the world, where they have tried that experiment and it has failed miserably. So I think ultimately, how much money can we afford to spend on our retired community? It all depends on how much the working sector of our economy is able to generate. And innovation over the last 20 years, 30 years, has really been the key to growth. And the U.S. has differentiated itself there with fiscal policies which are different than Europe and the rest of the world. And we've been very successful as a result.
Dr. Margaret Flowers.
Thanks, sure. It's hard to even know where to start after that, but I guess in terms of are these cuts necessary? They're absolutely not necessary. Medicare and Social Security operate outside of the federal budget. They fund themselves. There's great data that shows that we could actually make Social Security stronger, increase the benefits, more stable if we use some, you know, raise the cap, if we taxed income from capital gains as income, then we could actually strengthen Social Security, make it not a poverty retirement, but an actual quality retirement. Medicare as well. We're strengthening the wrong parts of Medicare, which is the private insurance part, Medicare Advantage, and weakening the part that's the best part, the traditional Medicare, which if we expanded that to every person, we could cover everyone in the country for the same amount of money or less as what we're spending right now. We live in a nation where we don't really have to be worried about debt, and our deficit is actually falling. So we have a sovereign currency, and we could actually print money and support these programs that way. But what we're seeing is that these are actually, I'm surprised that Ed says that this is different from Europe. What we're doing in this country is actually similar to what they're doing in Europe. It's imposing austerity measures, defunding public programs, forcing privatization. This will lead to a recession. We should actually be doing the opposite. We should be investing in full employment, a secure retirement, and health security for all, and that would stimulate our economy.
So before we all jump into this thing and agree and disagree with what everybody's just said, let me just ask a question. I think that the question that Margaret Flowers just raised, Ed Conard, which is whether or not Social Security and Medicare are actually outside this budget process. And some people argue that they should only be part of this discussion.
Yeah, I think that's looking at finances with one eye closed. It doesn't matter which pocket the money's in. All the money comes out of our private sector and goes to pay the various things that the government funds. You know, you can use accounting to pretend that something's outside the system, but from an economic perspective, nothing's outside.
I don't think there's any argument that a trust fund for Social Security is outside of the system. That's not a controversial issue. You're just giving straight misinformation there.
I just think there's no money in the trust fund, because if we ever had to pay the money back that supposedly is in the trust fund to fund Social Security, then we would have to cut other programs or otherwise have a very large increase in taxes.
So we can print $85 billion a month
and pay back all the debt. So I think it's just a misnomer to think that anything is outside the economic system.
But it's okay for us to print $85 billion a month through the Federal Reserve to give to big banks for quantitative easing, which they then hoard. It's not okay for us to print that same money to provide our social programs for people in our country. This is the information that's not being given.
I think this is a very much of a mischaracterization of what is going on in terms of the banking system. So, first of all, if we print money and spend it, that's no different than spending money. I would remind everybody that even though the government bailed out the banks in the financial crisis, the government's actually going to make a profit on the money that they gave to the bank. So the amount of money that was consumed by the banking system is actually net negative. It's produced a profit for the government, not a loss for the government. Now, the money that's sitting idle inside of our banking system, I think we're way off the issue of the budget. I would argue to you that people recognize that there's much more risk today than they realized in 2007, that the economy has dialed back its risk-taking, and you see that in high unemployment numbers, slower growth numbers, and a lot of output sitting idle inside of our banking system where idle output sits. And so, you know, we can broaden this conversation to be very, very broad, but I assume we wanted to be a little bit more narrow on the on the budget.
Well, I just think we need to respond to what you're saying about risky behavior. The banks are engaging in incredibly risky behavior right now, putting our entire economy at risk through their investments and derivatives. It's not that people are dialing back on their risky behavior. It's actually increasing.
Yeah, so, I would say that that's... So, you know, I think that's 180 degrees opposite of what's happening. We know that the economy is dialed down and risk-taking. The growth rate is slowed down. Unemployment has risen as a result. I mean, it's a classic Keynesian. You know, we can go beyond just the Keynesian problem, but if you just think about it in Keynesian terms, there's a lot of money sitting idle unused because people are unwilling to spend it and people are unwilling to invest it. And so it's sitting there in the banking system, and we get high unemployment and slow growth as a result.
So, Scott, you haven't had a chance to say anything in a minute. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of mystified by comments on both sides. Certainly, we can look at our federal budget, including Social Security or not including Social Security, but Social Security is a problem. We don't have the money in the trust fund to pay for it long term, and we are going to have to come up with other solutions. My feeling is that what we spend on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, all of which are driven by this tremendous increase in the number of elderly in this country, is well spent and something that most Americans support and would be very upset if we cut it. We need to make what cuts we can, but we also need to come up with the revenue to pay for it. And I would strongly disagree with Ed that there's any evidence that a country that raises 20% or 22% in taxes has a slower growth rate than one that doesn't. I mean, in the late 90s, we were raising 20% in revenues, and we had a much more rapid growth rate than we've had since then when we cut our tax rate to 15 or 14%. So I think we can pay for most of these costs. We can cut back where we can. But we need to have a balanced approach, and there's no reason we can't pay the taxes for the goods and services that we need.
The only thing I would say there is I think it's disingenuous to say that we had higher taxes in the 1990s and grew faster. Okay, we also invented and commercialized the Internet.
It may be disingenuous, but it's true.
We commercialized the Internet in the 1990s, and our growth rate accelerated significantly. We had lower tax rates relative to the rest of the world. And so while everybody's growth rate increased as a result of the commercialization of the Internet, Europe and Japan had access to the same technology and had similarly educated workforces, and they were not able to capitalize on it the way we were able to capitalize on it. And some of the significant differences are lower marginal tax rates, even though they were higher relative to what they had been before, they're significantly lower relative to the rest of the world. And we enjoyed significantly higher growth rates despite the fact that they had access to the same technology and similarly educated workforce.
That whole period came to a crashing end when we cut the taxes on high-income people so that we could have all of this money to invest. And so far, we haven't seen any investment and we haven't seen any job growth.
Margaret?
It's not at all controversial that when we had higher tax rates back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that what big business did was they didn't pay those high taxes because they did not take income. They reinvested their money back into their corporations and created jobs. Ever since the 1980s, when we started dialing back on the taxes, what we've seen is the exact opposite, where people hoard their money and we're seeing fewer jobs. There has continued to be growth in GDP of the United States, but most of that growth is going to the top 1%. Over the last few years, while we saw a decrease in the amount of money that the lower 99% made, the upper 1% made 121% of the economic recovery since 2008. That's where the money is going, and that's what happens when you tax at low rates. This is not a controversial issue. It's not questionable.
Well, I would remind everybody that let's go back to the 1950s, okay? We used interstate highway investment and television. We knitted the U.S. economy together into a mass market, and a lot of companies raced to take advantage of the economies of scale that were created at that time. We also were way out in front of educating our workforce relative to the rest of the world, And so we opened up opportunities that didn't exist prior to everybody going to college, because we sent everybody to high school before. Then we destroyed the rest of the world's infrastructure with the Second World War. We didn't invest for two decades, first from the Great Depression and then from the war. In the private sector, we killed 500,000 men in the war, and we had a dearth of births in the 1930s. So there are many factors going on to increase the growth rate in the 1950s and 1960s, which do not exist today. And we know that growth rate slowed down in the 70s and 80s from that manufacturing-based economy.
That's a nice story.
Since then, we've grown sevenfold, and physical inputs have grown twofold. Almost all of the growth in the United States has come from innovation. It has not come from the factors that accelerated growth in the 1950s and 1960s. The U.S. alone has been able to capitalize on these factors. Europe and Japan have been left behind with similar old-style economies that you're describing that were successful in the 50s and 60s and have not continued to be successful up to this point.
So let me get a quick thought here from Margaret and back to Scott, and open with the phones. Birch, you're going to be the first caller up. We're going to come to your call.
Well, I think we need to get back to the point that Scott made, where he's trying to say that we need a balanced approach, which is really the Democratic rhetoric that's being used right now. And it's a front for putting in place austerity measures and increasing privatization of our public programs so that it benefits Wall Street. We can deal with our elderly population in one of two ways. We can cut back on their programs, which we know will definitely cause more poverty, more suffering, and more death. Or we can actually, as a country that has sovereign currency, we can actually create, print money, invest that in those programs, strengthen them, which will stimulate the economy from the bottom up. Or rather than that, we could change our tax code to actually tax a lot of the income that's escaping tax right now and use that to invest in our elderly. That's the dichotomy. It's, are we willing to cause suffering and death of our elderly, or are we willing to take the wealth that we have and use it to support them?
Now, Scott, let me let you jump in before we go to the phones.
Well, I'm not proposing suffering and death for the elderly. In fact, I turned 66 last November, so what?
Well, I'm sure the Center for American Progress, you're enjoying a nice income, so I don't think you have to worry about it.
But I think that we need to defend these programs, but they are growing at an incredible rate. And I think the one thing that bothers me the most about the course we're on is that we are going to fund programs for the elderly at the expense of children, education, science, and infrastructure. And that is exactly what's happening right now.
Yes.
And I think it's a terrible mistake, because much more than tax breaks for the wealthy, I think government investments are an important part of a growing economy. And that's exactly what's being squeezed out.
You know, I wish that could be true, but if you look at what Obama just did, he's giving $71.5 billion to Medicare Advantage, which is the least effective, least efficient part of our Medicare program. It's going to cause our Medicare costs to go up. So if he was actually serious about funding these programs, instead of investing that $71.5 to $104.5 billion in private insurance, which caused the private insurance stock to surge last week when he announced that, he would put that into our traditional Medicare and not put more of the out-of-pocket costs on our seniors, which is going to lead to them not being able to get care.
So let me do this first. I promise to go to the phones.
I'm sorry.
No, that's cool. Get some callers in here before we go to break. 410-319-8888. Bert, you're on the air.
Hi, Bert. Mark, is this Mar on the air?
Yes, you are, Bert.
Thanks for taking my call. And I wanted to say, I didn't catch the young lady's name that's there with you, but
Dr. Margaret Flowers.
She is right on point for me, it sounds like. I couldn't be agreeing. Everything she said right there fits in my corner. And, I'm looking at the big picture. I don't really, feel that we live in a democracy anymore. This is more of like, is it a plutocracy or a plutonomy?
Yes.
I mean, and, I think it's a no-brainer that, if you take money from the masses, which is a capitalist society, is a goods and services society. If you take that away, they can't spend for those goods and services. So, in fact, the whole economy shrinks. I mean, that, basically, taxing or letting all the loopholes go through for big business and not making them pay their fair share shoots themselves in the foot. I mean, because then nobody's going to be able to buy their products or services. We don't have any money. That's the way it is. It's just going to go downhill. So I think capitalism is on its way to fail, and it's just a matter of time, the way we're heading. And Obama doesn't seem to be helping. Like the young lady said, he talks a good game, but I think his corner's already been bought and sold by the same people all along.
Bert, appreciate you for holding on and joining us here. Scott, why don't you jump at that first?
Well, I can understand people who are frustrated with the president, and I think we live in very difficult times. On the other hand, I think we're facing two choices, and the choice that Margaret is putting before us is not a choice that is within the frame of reference in this town, nor do I expect it to be anytime soon. So I respect her right to have those feelings, but that's not an option given the political system we're in or the people that are elected to office in this country right now. And I would point out, you know, that these elderly people that were trying to protect their benefits voted 56% for Mitt Romney, and I think they've got to come to their own defense before people like Margaret are going to be able to help them.
I think we need to see, right through what's going on, and that this the plan to cut our social insurances has been a long-term plan of President Obama when he created the National Commission for Fiscal Responsibility and Reform in April of 2010 and put 14 of the 18 were deficit hawks, appointed Simpson and Bowles. Paul Ryan was on that. It was pretty clear at that time that those policies that were created in that commission were going to be put forward in some sense, whether they were done in a straightforward way by the Republicans, who are more honest about what they're doing, or if they were going to be done in a slower, kind of sneakier way, which is what the Democrats are tending to do at this point. The plan has been all along for the last 3 to 4 years to defund our public programs and privatize them further, and I think people are more and more starting to see that, that both the Democratic and Republican parties really represent the interests of Wall Street, not the interests of the people. And so if you say that, by electing Obama, we elected someone who was going to, cut programs for the elderly, all of us shot ourselves. Everyone who voted for them shot themselves in the foot.
So then let me ask you your perspective before we take a few minutes before we go to break here, Ed Conard. I mean, so what is, from your perspective, the future of Medicare and Social Security? How do you envision it in the next 25 years?
Well, no one is talking about cuts, by the way. No one's talking about old people dying and falling by the wayside. They're talking about slowing the growth in medical expenditures that have occurred over the last years, where the amount of medical expenditures per enrollee has gone up significantly faster than GDP and the income of the workers who are footing the bill for those increases. And I would also remind everybody that even though there's plenty of poverty in the elderly, as there is throughout our economy, that the elderly as a demographic is perhaps the richest demographic in our economy. So, and the last thing I would say is on Medicare Advantage, I think the only thing we have found so far to slow the growth of medical expenditures has been HMO-like structures that existed in the 1990s. And we're successful at slowing the growth. And that is what Medicare Advantage is. So, having that experiment in place to try to understand what impact it will have on future growth rates of medical expenditures, I think is more important perhaps than we realize. But again, I would only tell people that we're talking about slowing growth rates, which are unsustainable given the number of workers we have coming per retired person in the future.
We're going to take a very brief break, and we're going to come back and continue our conversation with our three guests on Social Security, Medicaid, and the president's proposals, and give you an update from Boston. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Stein, and welcome back. On our way back to our conversation, I want to tell you all the latest news updates. There was a third explosion. There was a third explosion in Boston at the JFK Memorial Library. that also took place. They not sure what happened exactly. Things are still being pieced together. Channel 5 in Boston is reporting now that the devices that went off were small, maybe in a backpack, maybe hidden in a briefcase. These were not car bombs, but they were kind of, they think, homemade bombs. They don't have any information about that yet. They've now evacuated the Tufts Medical Center's emergency room. There must have been some threats there. They weren't sure. And so all that's going on. That's all the information we have. Again, the website to go to, we just found out that you want to go to, is the American Red Cross website, safeandwell.community.org, .community.org. And that'll be up on our website as well, where you can log in and try to find out what happened to people you know who may have been in or around the Boston Marathon when these explosions took place. And as we get further updates, we will, if anything really major happens that we can share with you, if news is an update, we will break in and let you know. But that's what we have so far, and we'll keep keep you abreast as much as we can and come back to this tomorrow and cover it in greater depth. We are here with Dr. Margaret Flowers, co-director of itsourEconomy.us, and co-host of the radio show Clearing the Fog, Ed Cunard, who is the American Enterprise Visiting Scholar, author of Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong, and Scott Lilly, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a former congressional aide, and you, 410-319-8888, write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, or jump onto our Facebook pages and join that there. And you were trying to say something.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond. There were two things that Ed said. One was talking about the desire to control health care costs, and he pointed to Medicare Advantage as a model. But Medicare Advantage is actually more expensive than traditional Medicare. We spend more on Medicare Advantage patients, enrollees, than we do on traditional Medicare. And actually, our most efficient programs have been our traditional Medicare and also the Veterans Health Administration. He also said that that we were not looking at benefit cuts. But again, they're often not called benefit cuts. You know, when the president cut reimbursement to physicians, he didn't call that a benefit cut, but in effect it is, because then those physicians see fewer Medicare patients. What we're seeing right now is increased deductibles and copays put on the elderly, which amounts to a benefit cut. Either they accept those increased medical costs, or they can pay more, which is estimated to be $195 to $350 a month for supplemental coverage to cover those cuts. Those actually are benefit cuts.
Yeah, I think if you look at the actual spending per enrollee, it's gone up, not down. So, you know, has everybody realized that co-payments are critical to controlling healthcare expenditures? Yes. And so,
No. That's not
co-payment. Co-payment has been used throughout the economy to manage the growth in healthcare expenditures, which have grown significantly faster than GDP and worker incomes have. And have they been expanded to Medicare as well? Yes.
That Medicare is a victim of our current market-based healthcare system, which is the most expensive in the world, primarily because we have a very complex system that's about, it's one-third of our healthcare costs go to administration alone, and that's crazy because Medicare has administrative costs of around 3% or less. But it's a system that's about creating profit, not about creating health for our population. The reason that our Medicare costs are going up is because our entire system's healthcare costs are going up, because we don't negotiate for reasonable prices for services or pharmaceuticals. But if you look at Medicare compared to the private insurance portion of our healthcare system, Medicare is rising at a slower rate. It's an excellent model that we could be using for everyone.
Well, Scott, let me ask you this question. I mean, when people argue from the Democratic side around these issues in Congress now, and some congressmen have said to us, there are things that don't seem to be discussed at all, and should they be discussed? Maybe they shouldn't. But whether it's issues like how you control the cost of pharmaceuticals and the ability to do bulk buying, or issues around controlling hospital costs, and certain, they were not looking at all the costs of things so much as looking at what people are paying for them and cutting those. Is that fair, Scott?
Well, right now I think we're in a ridiculous situation where we're paying a great deal more under Medicare for exactly the same drug than we're paying under the Medicaid program. And the only reason I can figure out that's true is because of the pharmaceutical lobby has carved that out. And I think that's, if you want to find savings in entitlement programs, that's the very first place I would go to do that. But I would also agree with Margaret that when you add copayments, when you limit coverage, when you cut back on that, you are basically right now, people on Social Security spend about 15% of their entire income on out-of-pocket expenses, anytime you change that, you add to these copayments, then you increase that amount, and it's basically the same as a cut in your Social Security benefit. That's not something, contrary to what Ed said earlier, is not something that most elderly can afford. Two-thirds of the elderly get less than $15,000 a year in Social Security benefits, and a quarter of those have no income at all other than that, and another quarter have very little income beyond that. So we're not talking about a lot of rich people here. It's a big problem. We need to try to figure out how to take care of the elderly and at the same time protect the budget, and that's not easy to do. But that's the job we have, and anybody who thinks that we can do that without more revenue is just simply not looking at the numbers.
So the question, I guess, becomes, I mean, if for all of you, both politically in terms of realistically and also in terms of what the country needs, was President Barack Obama's proposal the one that should be put on the table? Is an alternative that might work in America that could be debated or not? I mean, that's, some people are asking that because they're seeing, well, this maybe there's no choice, that this may be the only thing that one could do, Margaret.
Right, and that's what's being framed by the Democrats, is saying that this is an unfortunate compromise that the president has to make, and this is not an unfortunate compromise. What this is a long-term plan that President Obama has had to cut our social programs, which will lead to privatization for them. Actually, Jonathan Gruber said at the National Press Club maybe 5 or 6 months ago that the intention was that in 5 years the Medicare program would be put onto the health insurance exchange, that people would be given money to purchase private insurance through the health insurance exchange, and instead of our traditional Medicare program, which has been a defined benefit guaranteed program for our seniors, he wants to put it into the market-based program, we could have a whole other discussion about that. So what we're seeing is that, you know, I wrote an article back in December outlining the first three tries that Obama used to cut these social programs that were not successful, and now that those failed, he's just unilaterally cutting them. This whole argument about it being necessary and it's a bone to throw to the Republicans in exchange for some tax increases is ridiculous. He gave that same excuse during the health reform process. Says that same tactic did not work then.
Well, I would suggest we put it into...
Ed, go ahead, then we'll go to Scott.
Okay, I would say just we should put everything in perspective, which is this year we're going to run $850 billion deficit. That is not including $400 to $500 billion in interest payments, because interest is basically running at zero when we're funding our deficit at short-term rates. You add those together, you're talking about a budget deficit which is larger than all of the income tax that we raised this year. And so when you talk about the proposal that the president has put forward, it's $1 trillion of tax increases over 10 years. That's $100 billion a year. Remember, we're trying to close something probably close to a $1.3, $1.4 trillion gap. And the chain CPI that we're talking about is about $130 billion over 10 years. That's $13 billion a year. These are tiny, tiny little changes relative to what our policymakers, lawmakers need to do in order to bring the situation back into equilibrium. There's not enough taxes proposed here to close the gap. There is not enough spending to close the gap. And I would remind everybody that that is on optimistic CBO forecasts into the future, which have the economy growing at 4% a year for the next 3 years. They keep pushing it off a year every year. No slowdown from tax increases and no recession over the next 10 years. So extremely optimistic underlying forecasts. So to say that we don't need these things, I think, is putting our head in the sand relative to the situation that we really face.
And Scott Lilly.
Well, I agree with Ed that the items that the president has proposed at this date are very modest. I think any senior citizen who thinks that they're not going to have to give up at least that much before we get through this is not well informed and does not know what's at stake, which is unfortunate because it's their well-being that is at stake. I'm afraid that they are going to face much, much deeper cuts. And I really have to say I'm a little bit appalled at Margaret saying that she knows what the president wanted to do from the beginning, and that people are that disagree with her policy prescriptions or tools of Wall Street. I don't think that helps us get to the bottom of this problem or find out constructive solutions.
Well, I've often written about constructive solutions, and if people go to my website, clearingthefogradio.org, you can see that there are many solutions
to
these problems.
It's up to the country.
These are solutions that are supported by supermajorities of people around the country who would like to see us actually strengthen Social Security, which is the strongest leg of our retirement program, and now we're cutting it. They would like to see us create an improved Medicare for all. The policies that are being put forth by both the Democratic and Republican Party are hands down not what the American people want, and not solutions to our problems.
Scott, was that you trying to break in?
You need to do some polling on the revenues to pay for that.
Well, we did our own supercommittee hearing on...
Everybody is in favor of spending money on good things.
Well,
certainly I am.
You know, when we see the president going to Israel and giving Israel another $40 billion for weapons while he's cutting people's ability to get health care and food here in our own country, it's a little disturbing. But we had our own supercommittee hearing in Washington. You can go to October2011.org and read the results of our deficit proposal, which would actually find the $1.2 trillion that President Obama needs in a two-year period through a progressive taxation.
So, and actually, let me get some final thoughts here as well from Scott and Ed before we have to go. Scott, you still there?
Yes, I'm. Did you want a question from me?
No. I just want to get final thoughts around the room here before we have to go.
Well, I think this is a good discussion. I think people need to get very fixed on this because a lot of people have a lot at stake and they don't realize how much there is at stake. But there is either going to be significant benefit cutbacks or there's going to be some revenue increases. And I think voters need to put their representatives on the spot and find out which side they're on, because if they're not on one of those two sides, they're in favor of a big increase in the debt.
Gentlemen, we have to take a break here. I appreciate all of you of being part of this program today. That was Scott Lilly. He's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, former congressional aide. Ed Conard has joined us, American Enterprise Institute visiting scholar. His book, Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong. And Dr. Margaret Flowers, co-director of itsoureconomy.us and co-host of the radio show Clearing the Fog. Folks, well, thank you so much for being with us. We look forward to more lively discussions like this to get ideas on the table. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we're going to take a very brief break. And when we come back, we'll give you more updates from Boston, as well as we're going to start our interview with Sonia Nazario from the, as I like to call it, Conversations from the New York Times. She wrote an op-ed piece, Child Migrants Alone in Court. We'll be right back. Stay with us.